Hello, and welcome back to Heard and Not Seen, a podcast from Barnardo's. So far, the Oral History Project episodes shared this month have all been conversations between two people from different generations, brought together to discuss a shared life experience. In this episode of our Oral History Project, we interview our colleague Chris, who works in our very own fundraising department, and who tells us about his own life experiences growing up with Caribbean heritage in East London in the 1970s and 80s. He reflects on how his own cultural identity has changed over the years. He talks about Black history still not being part of the UK curriculum, and explains the importance of having conversations about culture, race and heritage.
My name's Chris Alexander. A lot of people tend to know me as Christopher Alexander. I've been with Barnardo's approximately 2 years next month. So my role is really to ensure that the donors' experience of giving to Barnardo's is a good one, that they continue giving to the Barnardo's, and hopefully they continue giving to Barnardo's incrementally.
How would you describe your own cultural identity?
If you'd have asked me this maybe 20 years ago, it would have been kind of a very staunch Black British, simply because although my parents are from the Caribbean, I didn't have, I wasn't kind of Caribbean aware, simply because we lived in the UK. We never went to the Caribbean. And although my parents spoke the language of their country, I did everything, as a black British boy would be doing, playing out, going clubbing, going to the cinema, going out with my mates, doing everything like that. However, my identity has kind of mellowed or morphed over the last few years, and I have an affinity to the island of my parents' birth. I'm very much interested in what happens there. I'm actually a citizen of that island as well, so I've got my own kind of passport. And although obviously I live in the UK, I travel frequently to the Caribbean. I travel at least twice a year. I would say I'm kind of, the leaning is now kind of 60-40, to the Caribbean rather than to the UK.
When did you first become aware of race?
Yes, I thought about this question. It's a really interesting one. I wasn't aware of my race until I left my secondary school. It was about 3 weeks into the summer holidays after leaving secondary school, and thinking what you're going to do, and I think I was lining myself up to go to college, and it was at that time I heard that two former schoolmates of mine, one had moved to a place called South Ockendon, and another was seen on a National Front march. I didn't know, I thought, oh, South Ockendon, it might as well be, China for all as I was aware. But it became made aware to me that South Ockendon was a place of where a lot of people from, at the time, the National Front moved to when they moved out of East London. It was like you could see a migration. People moved from East London to some parts of Essex, and those are one of the parts of Essex. And to later find out that this person moved because his family were National Front members, and another ex-pupil who we thought, and I use the word we, kind of the collective group, school year group, thought he was kind of our quote-unquote friend, to later see, 3 weeks later on the National Front march, demonstrating, it was a bit bizarre. And then I became aware of my race because I thought, well, these people I thought were my friends, but it was clear that they weren't, because although they, they were on the face of it kind of friendly to me, there was an underlying and more kind of sinister theme behind it. So it was clear that they were suppressing their real kind of feelings whilst being at school with me. So that's when it kind of hit me, being a young person of colour. I must admit, what I did when I was younger, I'm a DJ, so DJing in clubs up and down the country and abroad, I had, some special incidences where I was refused entries to clubs, only to kind of go back into my car. I turn up at a club, as you would, and then for the bouncers to say, not tonight, mate. and then come back 5 minutes later with my record boxes, and they'd be like, "Oh, we didn't know you was a DJ. Come in." And so, you know, it was very apparent then. But I've never really been, I've always been aware of my race per se, but not the kind of negative connotations of it until that time. But again, I think it's about who you mix with, and the people predominantly that I mix with aren't racists. And if they were, they wouldn't be part of my social circle.
As a kind of young teenager, did you fully comprehend what the National Front was?
My kind of awareness of it was really through like the media. And a lot of the time, the way it was reported in the media, it was more a party that was against the ruling government at the time. They were arguing or protesting against elements of things that they weren't happy with that the government were delivering at the time. Obviously, living in East London, I didn't live too far away from places like Brick Lane, which had a huge kind of Asian and particularly Bangladeshi community. So you had the scenario where the British media were portraying a story about the National Front and the BNP, but on the ground you saw a different story because you saw skinheads, you saw people marching, you saw people protesting. But the media were very much more inclined to show the BNP and the National Front fighting with the anti-Nazi League, but they didn't want to show skinheads beating up young black boys or young Asian boys who were protesting at the time. You know, that's not what they didn't want to show that. So there was very much a kind of pro-white, and I think it was you know, a sign of the times. You know, it was very much a kind of pro-white story that they were showing. If we thought Tommy Robinson was, you know, vocal now, imagine where you had a platform where you could literally say what you want and there'd be no repercussions. You wouldn't have an outrage that you have now. But growing up in the 60s and 70s in the East End, where you had this around you all the time, it was a difficult experience. But if you told me, would I swap it with living with another part of the UK, I'd probably say no, because it made me the person that I am now.
Was Black history taught to you?
No, not at all. Black history has, you know, I would say, honestly, in the last, when we started this interview, you asked about cultural identity, and I told you about hopefully where I'm going and my kind of leanings. And what I decided to do was teach myself Black history, and predominantly I teach myself about the history of the Caribbean and St. Lucia in particular. So my kind of leaning is towards authors from the Caribbean and that diaspora. So I'm self-taught, to put it politely. It wasn't taught to me in schools. And as far as my son and my daughter are concerned, who are, you know, my son's in uni and my daughter's working, it wasn't taught to them either. And I think, you know, in 2020, it kind of pains me to say it, I've made the point in several circles that you shouldn't have a Black History Month. You should just have it integrated within kind of the history curriculum, as you should have history of other cultures. But I see the kind of sense in making Black history stand out to an extent. But no, it wasn't taught to me. It wasn't taught to me. Two, I never asked about it, because I think upon reflection, the history that would have been taught to me wouldn't have been the right history, because I think what we now know is the history that was taught, whether it be the 70s or the 80s or to an extent in the 90s, so much of it has since been corrected. And there's much more that's out there, whether it be, you know, the written word, the spoken word, songs, films.
When did that self-teaching process begin?
I think it happened when I first went to the Caribbean, whether I went to places like Derek Walcott, the Derek Walcott Museum. Derek Walcott was a poet laureate. Reading some of his workings and kind of realizing that the Caribbean had a huge wealth of authors, biographers, storytellers, who had put their stories down into prose.
What was your experience of growing up in East London in the 1960s and 70s?
60s, I can't remember. I was born in 65, so I was, you know, in a pram for a number of years in the 60s. In the 70s, it was all I can remember, to be honest with you, is how, you know, and this is where, you know, young people of today really don't know what they're missing. Growing up in the 70s, you could literally, and I say this as truth, you could go out at 9 o'clock in the morning, come back at 6 o'clock in the evening, and your parents didn't have to worry about you. You could have gone, you know, I could go from East London to West London, from West London to North London, from North London to South London, and be, as long as I was back home for dinner and I didn't come back with a policeman in tow, then I was, you know, I had license to roam. Yeah, it was simpler times, and it was difficult times. I must admit, it was difficult times, but it was a happier time. And I think I don't dismiss the fact that things were going on, because things were going on. But I think the sense of fear, I am of a generation where we are scared for our children. And it's very, very interesting, because I doubt our parents were scared for us when we were going out. So I don't know when this culture of fear suddenly developed parents of my age range, but it suddenly did. And they put a protective shield around their children. And because of that, you know, it was don't go out, or you can't go far, or you can't do this, or you can't do that, or if you're going to do this, I'm coming with you. If my mum and dad said, oh, we're going to Shepherd's Bush, or we're going to White City with you, I'd be like, well, I'm not going. It's as simple as that. But if you know, my son, who doesn't live with me now, he's at uni, but if he said, oh, Dad, I'm going to such and such, I would have said, okay, I'll pick you up at this time, or call me when you're there, and call me when, if anything happens, call me. But luckily, I've been kind of engendered in him that he can go around, as long as he's smart, and he can see the signs, he can go where he likes and be cautious.
What did your parents do for a living when you were growing up?
Ah, great. My mother worked for the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel. She was a cleaner. And I'll always remember this. When I used to come home from school, I used to get home about 4:30. And I'd have my dinner about 4:45, because 5:10 on the dot, my mother used to leave to go to work. And if she didn't leave at 5:10, she wouldn't get the bus to go to work. And she'd come back at 9:30. And Dad was worked on a building site, and he worked for a company called Waite Building. He'd worked for them for years, and so wherever the contract was, he went. So whether it be outside of London or inside, it was predominantly inside London. So he would work anywhere, and he would you know, my dad would leave home at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he'd come back kind of dirty and dusty at like around 6 o'clock in the evening or 7 o'clock in the evening. So that's what they did for a living. And they worked. My mother worked there until she retired, and my dad did the same thing. He worked there until he retired.
How has society's attitude towards immigrants changed since your parents came to England?
People are a bit more kind of softer towards immigration. I think people are a bit more welcoming towards immigrants, because I think they've seen, again, and this pandemic has been a great example of how people from various diasporas are contributing to English society in a number of ways. Plus, they are putting their own imprint on it. So what I'm seeing as a black person is a lot more people of Caribbean heritage putting an imprint on, you know, businesses and services, and people from African heritage and Asian heritage and Chinese heritage doing exactly the same, whether it be small businesses, pop-ups, whatever it is. So people are more kind of culturally aware. And I think education is the best thing. It's educating yourself, and these people are there to educate those that want educating. If you ask a person, as you're asking of me, tell me about your cultural identity, or tell me about your Caribbean roots, I'll happily tell you. If you ask any other person of colour about their cultural identity and their roots, they'll happily tell you. And I think people need to have the conversation. because if they don't have the conversation, ignorance is a terrible thing, and ignorance leads to fear and hatred. So ask. If you want to know, ask. People are not shy in telling you, and they'll be quite pleased to tell you, as I am pleased to tell you, proud to tell you.
And when did the DJing and kind of love for music, I guess, start?
If you ask a number of young black and or white DJs, when did it start? A lot of them will tell you it started with the sound system. You know, if you want to know more about sound systems, just, you know, take a trip down Notting Hill and you'll see loads of them. It started for me with a sound system. I was in the sound system for when I was growing up, you know, 16 and older, between the ages of like 16 to about 20. I was with the sound system. We were playing house parties and dances around London. And simply put, people started to say to me specifically, you're really good as a DJ yourself and you should do it yourself. So I took a step, did it by myself. And you know, it's taken me, I've DJed in St. Lucia, I've DJed in Switzerland, I've DJed in Croatia, I've DJed in Greece, Cyprus, everywhere. I play it down at work. Not many people know what I do, and they'll probably be shocked. But yeah, I balance it well. I used to be a resident DJ of two very well-known clubs in Covent Garden for a number of years, and then I kind of knocked it on the head because I wanted weekends to myself.
So just to bring it back, I guess, so your cultural identity has directly influences your music decisions and tastes?
No, because I play, like, I was growing up, you know, listening to soul and funk and jazz, so that's what I play. I play lots of new music. So listening to kind of calypso and soca, that's my wife's thing. I'm like, I can listen to it for about 15 minutes. She can listen to it all day. I can listen to it on the radio, fine, but in person, no thank you.
So that's the end of the standard questions. I was wondering, do you have anything else you'd like to add, or how are you feeling about that conversation?
It's really good because, I've not really spoken about my experiences to anyone, you know, like who I don't know as such. So it's been really, really good. But what I'm looking forward to is the other interviews, because it's always interesting to find or see another person's kind of point of view and their experience. As I said, my experience is a relatively positive one. Who knows what that other person's experience would be?
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. There's still more to come this Black History Month, so keep your eyes peeled. If you're enjoying these conversations, please think about leaving a rating and a review. It would really help us. For more information on the Oral History Project and to learn more about Chris, please visit the website at www.bernardos.org.uk/oralhistory. Thank you.